Chapter 1, Growing Up on Pepper Street. For many years, I failed to take my walk with the Lord seriously. I knew that I had a call of God on my life, but what was I supposed to do with it? I could not even understand the Bible when I read it, and I was confused by the time I finished reading. One evening, I sat on the sofa and pondered how that I needed to be completely sold out to the Lord. I made up my mind that I was not going to play games anymore. I wanted to fully commit my life and my future into His hands. It was May 4th, 2002, when I prayed, "Lord, whatever it takes, I want You to mold me and make me into what You want me to be. I want to be what You want me to be." The next day, I had a heart attack. 7 days later, I died. Ronnie's story. My mother said, "Lord, the doctors say I cannot have a child, but I know that with You all things are possible. If You will give me a child, I promise to raise him until he is of age. Then I will give him back to You." Had my mother known the things I would go through and the number of times I would die and come back to life, perhaps she would not have prayed that prayer. But the Lord answered, and 9 months later, on April 5th, 1943, here I came. True to her word, my mother, Wilma Posey, dedicated me to the Lord and promised to raise me properly and give me back to Him. Mother was a believer when she and my dad married. But my dad, Leroy Posey, was a sinner who came to church only to curse at the preacher. Mother finally quit attending church because she could not handle the embarrassment of her husband showing up and cursing the preacher. My parents lived in Poland, Georgia, and worked in the cotton mill, where raw cotton was picked apart and sent through several layers of processing. The final products were large bobbins of thread used for sewing. Summertime in South Georgia was miserably hot and humid, and sometimes the temperature inside the mill rose to 120 degrees. A light mist of water helped keep the dust down, but at the end of the day, the workers' lungs were full of cotton dust. We lived in a small house that was owned by the cotton mill, and back in the 1950s, our rent was $3 a week. Our house was located on Pepper Street, which was a nice, quiet street until the men in the neighborhood started drinking. Every Friday after they received their paychecks, the men went straight to the county line and bought liquor. That is when the trouble started. My father, Leroy, was one of those brawling drunkards. He had unlimited access to liquor because he and his brother operated a moonshine still. My friends and I discovered it by accident one day when we were fishing in the creek behind my grandmother's house, and I stepped on some boards and slipped. Thinking perhaps this was an old well, we moved the boards and could hardly believe what we saw: a moonshine still and gallons upon gallons of moonshine. Every Friday night, the men on Pepper Street drank until they became intoxicated. Then they headed to the trash dump to play poker. They covered the ground with an old blanket, and the men gathered around as they pulled out cards and poker chips. They bought a flambeau, a metal canister with a wick, which they used for light. Sometimes I carried a large bucket of water to the poker game and charged the men a quarter for a drink. Many times I came away with $6 a weekend, which was quite a sum of money in those days. When the poker game ended, the men either chased after women or went to a juke joint, today we call it a bar, where they continued to drink liquor. When the weekend came to an end, the men returned home and beat their wives. It frightened me to watch my dad come home after a weekend of drinking and beat my mother. At times, I was also a victim of his anger. He drilled holes in a leather strap that was about 4 inches wide and 3 feet long, and he attached it to a handle. When he hit me with that strap, I could hear the wind coming through those holes. Sometimes he hit me so hard that my feet lifted off the floor. There was even a time when he held me in front of the fireplace as he reached into his pocket, pulled out a handful of bullets, and threw them into the flames. Bullets fired all over the house, leaving holes in the walls and ceiling. Miraculously, not one bullet hit me. All the men on Pepper Street brought misery upon their families with their drinking, and Dad was no exception. He did ridiculous things, such as coming home with a snake wrapped around his arm, or bringing home a goat that almost destroyed everything in the house. Sometimes when he came home in a drunken condition, I slept underneath the house. Our house was over 3 feet off the ground, and I kept a blanket and cardboard box there, which I used as a bed. I was so unhappy living with my father that when I was 5 years old, I asked my maternal grandmother if I could come live with them. At first, my mother refused, but my grandmother finally convinced her to let me go. The 6 years that I lived with my grandparents were the happiest days of my young life. Each day, I was assigned farming chores, such as gathering eggs from the hen house or helping my grandfather feed livestock. Grandmother taught me manners. If I sat at the dinner table and reached for a biscuit without asking, she made me sit in another room until everybody else had finished eating. It didn't take me long for me to learn to ask, "May I have a biscuit, please?" Grandmother was a Christian, and every day she sat me down in a chair and we listened to Oral Roberts on the radio. At the end of the program, he always said, "Touch the radio if you have a need." Grandmother and I both touched the radio. I was always drawn to church. As a small boy, I often told people that I would grow up to be a preacher. Behind my grandparents' house was a beautiful creek where I played almost every day. I was at this creek one day when I heard a voice call my name. Thinking it must be my grandmother, I ran back to the house, but she had not called me. I went back to the creek and once again heard the voice say, "Ronnie." I returned to the house, but again she said she had not called me. By this time I was confused about the voice I had heard. I couldn't figure out who was calling my name. Back to the creek I went. After 30 minutes the voice called my name again, but louder this time as it said, "Ronnie." I was certain the voice must have been my grandmother because nobody else was around. For the third time I ran back to the house and said, "I know you called me this time. I heard you loud and clear." "No, I have not called you," she said, "but come in here and sit down. You might not remember this, and you will not understand it right now, but I want to tell you something. That was the voice of the Lord calling you. He has a work for you to do. Do you understand?" "Well, a little bit," I replied. "You remember what I said. Years from now, you will know what that means." As a child, I was not aware of a similar story in the Bible about Hannah and Samuel. A barren woman named Hannah prayed for God to bless her with a child, making a vow that if he did so, she would give the child back to the Lord for his service. A year later, Hannah gave birth to a boy that she named Samuel. She dedicated him to the Lord, and after he was weaned, sent him to the house of the Lord in Shiloh, where he was taught by Eli the priest. Samuel was still young and did not know the Lord in a personal way when he heard someone call his name 3 times. Each time Samuel thought that Eli was calling him. By the 3rd time, Eli perceived that the Lord had called the boy, and he told Samuel that the next time he heard the voice, he should say, "Speak, Lord, for your servant hears." When Samuel obeyed, the Lord gave him a prophetic word against the house of Eli. This was the start of Samuel's ministry as a prophet. My grandparents continued to be a positive influence, but the life I had known for the past 6 years would end abruptly over an incident with my cousin. One day, he and I planned to go swimming, so my grandmother gave me 50 cents for food and the pool fee. My cousin had no money, so we walked the half mile to his house. He told me to stay outside, and soon he returned with $1. That evening, his father came to my grandparents' home and accused me of stealing $1 from his wallet. I denied it, telling him that I stayed outside and already had money. He was certain I had taken the money because he just knew that his son would not have taken it. My grandmother gave him $1, and he left. That night, as I lay in bed, I heard my grandparents talking. "Frank," my grandmother said, "I was afraid this was going to happen. We have to send him back home. I could not stand it if he turned out to be a thief or ended up in jail." Surely they were not talking about me, I thought. This is my home. And I shuddered at the thought of going back to my parents' home because I knew what would be in store. It hurt me terribly to know that my grandmother would send me back home over something I did not do, or that she would even entertain the thought that I might become a thief. I cried all night, but to no avail. On Sunday, my grandparents took me back home. I headed for the backyard, crossed the creek, and stayed in the woods most of the night. I still could not believe that I was once again living with my dad. By this time, my mother had given birth to 4 more children, Eddie, Danny, Mary, and Sue. The first week that I was home, Dad got his paycheck, went to the liquor store, and played poker. Then he came home and beat my mother. We all scattered because we knew he would come after the rest of us. I spent many nights sleeping under the house after that. My paternal grandmother lived down the street in a little shack with no electricity, and sometimes my brothers and I spent the night there. We lit a lamp and read comic books until we fell asleep. Nothing much had changed on Pepper Street, but now I was 11 years old and noticed everything. I often ran the drunkards off our front porch by swinging a rake at them. The women brought other men into their homes when their husbands left the house, and the men chased other women on the weekends. Fighting was commonplace. One weekend, my Uncle Red, after being out drinking, showed up at our house holding his guts with his hands. He had gotten into a fight and someone sliced his abdomen open. It took 3 policemen to handcuff him so they could get him to the hospital. When people drank moonshine and whiskey, they would do almost anything. In many ways, life was as normal for me as it was for other boys who grew up during the 1940s and 50s. We made our own toys, bows and arrows from wood and twine, pop guns from wood with a soft center, and go-karts from cane syrup cans, wire, and sand. We hunted in the woods behind the house and fished in the nearby creek. Sometimes we used a light and caught fish with a forked stick or even with our bare hands. On the weekends, I hitchhiked 3 miles to town so I could see a cowboy movie with actors like Roy Rogers, Gene Autry, and John Wayne. But there was also a dark side that the boys on Pepper Street secretly dealt with. In our neighborhood were 2 men who molested the boys who lived on our street. One day I was walking home when one of the men stopped to give me a ride. I knew him and was not afraid to ride with him, so I got in the car. Instead of taking me home, he drove the car in a different direction, telling me that he would give me a quarter if I would expose myself. I became so afraid that I flung myself out the car window. Fearing that I would go back and tell someone what happened, he offered to take me home. I got in the back seat and he dropped me off at the place where he originally picked me up. Another man in our neighborhood did the same thing. He drove several of us home one night, and I was the last person in the car. He, too, told me to remove my pants, and I refused. "I'll kill you if you don't," he threatened. I almost did it out of fear, but this man saw something that was not visible to me. His eyes widened, and he said with a fearful voice, "I'll take him home! I'll take him home!" Perhaps he saw an angel. I do not know. However, I do know that I stayed far away from him after that. Other boys in my neighborhood always hung their heads after being around him. It was evident they were ashamed and embarrassed. This man instilled fear in all the boys on Pepper Street. I have no idea what finally happened to him, but one day he simply disappeared. He was there one day and gone the next. I never knew if he left town quickly because he was on the verge of getting caught or if somebody finally got him. If it became known that he was molesting boys, there's a good chance that somebody killed him, and nobody in the neighborhood ever said a word. When I was 15 years old, I dropped out of school and went to work in the cotton mill. I was 16 when I finally decided to do something about Dad coming home intoxicated and beating my mother. I had a heavy wooden-handled traverse key that was used to wind frames at the cotton mill, and I threw it at Dad's head with all my might. I barely missed hitting him. Had I succeeded, I might have killed him. I told him, "You had better not, as long as I live, hit my mother again, and you are not going to beat us anymore either." Dad went to work and came home that night without saying much. I could tell he was angry. That weekend, he got drunk and came home, but he didn't beat my mother. He cursed a lot, which was something he did not normally do. As I sat on the front porch with my mother as she snapped peas, I kept looking at Dad. Apparently, he thought I was challenging him. He went into the house and got a .22 rifle, put a bullet in it, came outside, put the gun to my head, and pulled the trigger. Thankfully, the gun didn't fire. Mother jumped up, grabbed the rifle, and threatened to kill Dad if he did not leave the house immediately. I took the bullet out of the rifle and saw that there was no mark showing where it had fired. For some reason, the pin didn't strike the bullet. I kept that bullet for a long time until I decided one day to see if it would fire. I put it in the same .22 rifle, pointed it up in the air, and pulled the trigger. It fired. That let me know without a doubt that there is a God who will protect you. There were five of us children, and my mother tolerated my father because she knew that she could not take all five of us and move in with her parents. Mother awoke at 5 o'clock each morning and went to work as a cotton winder. It was hard work, and she was always tired when she came home. After we ate supper, the children scattered. We did whatever we wanted and went to bed whenever we wanted. There were no rules in our house. Since Dad drank and gambled away much of the money he earned, it was our mother who paid for groceries and other necessities. But she finally wised up. When Dad came home intoxicated after playing poker, she waited until he passed out on the bed and started snoring. Then she had me check his pockets for any poker winnings. If we found money, she took most of it. He typically had $50 to $100, and she would leave $10 in his pocket and take the rest. One time he had $1,200 in his pocket, giving us the opportunity for quite a shopping spree. He had been so drunk the night before that when he woke up, he never missed the money. When Dad was sober, he was a good man. Thankfully, before he died years later in a nursing home, Dad accepted Christ and repented for all the terrible things he had done. When we told him that we forgave him for the way he treated us, tears rolled down his cheeks. Even with all the evil things he did on earth, the violence, beatings, drunkenness, and gambling, I knew without a doubt that he died a child of God. My dad's father was even meaner than my dad. When my grandfather was angry, he sometimes hit his horse so hard between the eyes with a 2x4-inch piece of wood that the horse fell down. When my grandfather died, we were told that, as he was dying, he screamed for someone to pull him out of hell. My grandmother and her children obediently pulled him from room to room as he hollered, "My feet are burning! Demons are pulling me into hell! Pull me out of hell!" Dad had a few odd relatives, including my Uncle Sam Posey, a very successful psychic and fortune teller who lived in Moultrie, Georgia. Uncle Sam made so much money as a psychic that he once owned 16 T-model Fords that were all lined up in his front yard. He kept his money in the cellar, stored in empty Prince Albert tobacco cans. He had rows and rows of cans that were filled with money. Dad lived with Uncle Sam for several years before he married my mother, and Sam bought Dad anything he wanted. There was a time when Dad stole some merchandise from the general store, and the owner was planning to press charges. Uncle Sam bought the store to keep Dad from being prosecuted and going to jail. People came from all over America in expensive chauffeur-driven cars to get psychic readings from Uncle Sam. I was playing outside one day when someone drove up in one of those expensive cars. Out stepped a woman who was lavishly dressed in fur and diamonds. "I am looking for Sam Posey," she said. I lost some expensive jewelry, and I want him to tell me where it is." I gave her directions to Uncle Sam's house, and she gave me a $20 bill. Uncle Sam told her to look for her jewelry on a shelf above the place where she washed clothes. Another time, a man's mule disappeared. He looked all over town and could not find it. He went to Uncle Sam and said, "If you can tell me where it is, I will come back and pay you. If you can't tell me, I'm not paying you a nickel." "Fair enough," Uncle Sam said. "Go down the street and take a left. Then go all the way down the road and take another left. When you come to a log in the woods that you have to step over, your mule will be down in the creek bed." The man followed the directions and found the mule. This kind of demonic activity was most likely passed down by my great-grandmother, a Cherokee Indian whom my great-grandfather bought for a mule and a horse when she was 14 years old. He was not much older than that himself, but he married her. I called her Granny Collier, but I never knew her first name. Granny Collier never worked a job, but she always had plenty of money, especially silver dollars. I heard strange stories about her. For instance, I heard that she briefly turned people that she didn't like, including the husband of my Aunt Emma, into animals. She also had a method of running people out of the neighborhood if she didn't like them. She would send her son to the graveyard to get some dirt. Then she took the dirt and walked into the woods with it. I have no idea what happened while she was in the woods, but when she returned, her son threw the dirt underneath or in front of the person's house. Within a few days, the people would move out of their home. I recall one neighbor who swore he would never move. He had settled there and had even planted a large garden. After the dirt was thrown under his house, he said, "I cannot understand this. I do not know why I am doing this, but I am moving." My grandmother, the daughter of Granny Collier, lived down a country lane with large fields on each side and woods behind the fields. I noticed a dark, shadowy figure following me as I walked to her house one night. The figure followed me all the way to her home. When I told my grandmother about it, she said, "Don't worry, it is not going to hurt you." Uncle Sam was Granny Collier's son, so perhaps that is why he was involved in this kind of occultic activity. Thankfully, he never attempted to pass fortune-telling or any of the other strange activities down to my father. At one end of Pepper Street was a Church of God of Prophecy. At the other end was an Assembly of God. Nobody on our street attended church, but we could still hear the services, especially when the weather was nice and the church windows were open. As a young child, I always felt connected to the Lord and was drawn to church, even though I was a rascal when I lived with my parents. Each Sunday, I went to church and stood outside the window until I saw my mother's parents drive up to our home. They visited us every Sunday, and I ran home as fast as I could the moment they arrived. Wesley Taylor was the pastor of the Church of God of Prophecy, and he was not bashful about preaching the Word of God. He often went to the woods next to the creek behind the church and prayed. His words sounded like a roar as people listened to him pray for hours in the woods. As time went on, people began to sit outside in chairs and listen to the services. Most would not go inside the doors of the church, but they were still able to hear the gospel preached.